Yeah, we're trying to figure out how to get them.
Hope you don't come call the meeting to order. Representative Poppy moved the minutes of the February 24th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, then all of the papers signify the state aye.
Aye.
Motion prevailed. Mr. Spitzenreiter, to the committee. Get started immediately.
Members, you remember, we weren't going to get the 30,000 foot view of the university, but now I understand it's 5,000 feet and landing. So we're going to get a really intricate presentation this evening. Welcome, Fifth, to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. If it was within my power to grant you a four-credit course after this discussion tonight, I would, but that's above my pay grade, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to do tonight is take you through really what we would call, that I often do with a variety of folks, is really a basic finance 101 about the University of Minnesota. I will, on occasion, and I think the ground rules tonight, Mr. Chairman, are that if people have questions as I go through, just interrupt and we'll deal with the questions and get back on track. And when, Mr. Chairman and members, I get in a jam, I'm going to phone a friend in the audience to give me a hand. But we'll get rolling.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, the first question I often get about the University of Minnesota from
folks... What sheet are you working off of, Dean?
Mr. Chairman, there is, I think in your packet, you have a presentation that looks like this, not quite this thick, and that's the slideshow I'll be going through. On occasion, I will also refer to attachments 1 to 4 that I wanted to leave you copies of, because the slides themselves have a lot of numbers on them and they're a little tough to read. So I'll be mostly working off a slideshow that's in front of you, and on occasion, in that slideshow, referring to this handout. As I was saying, the most frequent question I get about the University of Minnesota is just how big is the budget at the University of Minnesota? And when you look at the total all-funds budget of the University of Minnesota, it's approximately $3 billion a year. Now, the first distinction we make in that budget is whether that, and I'm going to use a lot of accounting terms tonight, but one of the first distinctions we make in the budget at the University of Minnesota is whether an activity, whether an expenditure is a sponsored project, a sponsored expenditure, or, and I'm not an accountant, they decided that if something was sponsored, everything else is non-sponsored. But let me talk about sponsored expenditures, and we'll get into this in a little more detail. So what we mean by that is expenditures that we make at the University of Minnesota on behalf of an external sponsor, someone, principally the federal government, gives us money to do research, and that is categorized in our accounting system as sponsored. Sponsored spending also relates to the fact that we have to provide the results of that activity in a report to an external party. So for accounting purposes, we call that sponsored. Everything else that we do, which is really the bread and butter activity at the university, is non-sponsored. When you look at the $3 billion budget at the University of Minnesota from a 30,000-foot level, you can see that state appropriations, and remember, we get our appropriations from the state in two forms, an O&M block grant and a state special, and that's approximately 26% of the total. Tuition, just the tuition rate, is about 20%. Indirect cost recovery, what that fund represents for that source of money, it's just about $100 million a year, represents reimbursement that the university gets on sponsored research activity. So earlier I said sponsored activity, we spend roughly $470 to $500 million a year. The federal government, or the sponsoring entity, often, but not in all cases, gives us an additional overhead on that for all our indirect costs. So we get a research grant from NIH, $100,000. We do that direct research in a lab at the University of Minnesota, where the university is paying the indirect costs, providing the equipment, the lights, the heat, the cooling, the indirect costs, if you will. And that's what the indirect cost recovery funds are. It's reimbursement to the University of Minnesota for expenses of research that occurs on our campus. Central Reserve is a very small pool of money that a level of central funds that are reserves for unexpected financial situations that is controlled specifically by the Board of Regents. It's the Board of Regents policy. That particular fund by board policy is required to be approximately 4% of the state appropriation. I will tell you that when we put the budget together last year, we anticipated the Central Reserve would be, the balance in Central Reserve would be approximately $25 million. Unfortunately, this, due to the global economic crisis, the university did lose roughly $9.9 million in a bond with Washington Mutual in that bankruptcy. And Central Reserve today, in addition to the fact that interest rates are down, sits at about $13.8 million as opposed to the board's required roughly a little over $26 million. Auxiliary enterprises at the university, about 9% of the budget, represent everything from housing, dining services, parking activity, intercollegiate athletic revenues, basically business operations at the university. Internal sales activities represent the fact that we have a fleet operation, and it charges other university departments to rent fleet vehicles, or we run an internal printing business. That's the kind of activity that goes on in internal sales. Miscellaneous income and sales and fees, 7% of the total. The university does an enormous amount of sale of services. Give you an example. When we have spare time on a magnet that we do research on, and by magnet I mean MRIs and CAT scans, when we have spare time on that piece of equipment, we make that available and charge for it for the other hospitals and doctors, for example, in the state or outside the state. So we generate a lot of income through the activities of the faculty all over the university. Restricted gifts and endowments, about 11% of the money. Bear in mind, and we'll talk about it some more later, but this money comes over to the university from the University of Minnesota Foundation or the Minnesota Medical Foundation or off of endowments managed on the university's book. And this, as you know, an endowment is put in place for really intergenerational equity in perpetuity, and the payout on that endowment at the university runs roughly 4.5% a year, and that money comes over and is deposited and expended on the university's books. And then, as we mentioned earlier, sponsored funds are about 15%. This chart gives you, the next slide, slide four, gives you the average annual growth in these revenue sources.
Mr. Fissinger?
Yes, sir.
I've got a couple of questions. First of all, on the endowments, what kind of money are we talking about that we lost since this whole stock market and economy crash?
Mr. Chairman, members, at the most recent figures, I know the market collapsed heavily since December 31st of 08. We will, all the endowments will price again in the next quarter, but based on the December 31, 2008, numbers, the university and MMF and UMF lost similar money, approximately year over year of a 22% decline in the value of the endowment. It has dropped further since those December 31 numbers.
$22 million?
22% on roughly of the value today, and I have a slide later. The value of our managed funds are around $2.6 billion. On December 30th of 2008, that number stood at about $3.6 billion.
And the last question is, you know, self-proclaimed world's worst capitalist at the legislature, I'd like to know, how does the university benefit from internal sales activities when you're just charging each other for something?
Mr. Chairman, on the
more of an accounting?
Internal sales activity?
Right.
You know,
how do you make money off yourself?
Well, we cover our costs. We're not making money. We run a printing operation. Now, it could be argued we should outsource the printing operation. We used to run a laundry for the hospital. We got rid of it and outsourced it. We run certain internal activities that we think are financially more competitive than shipping them outside the university to the external site. It's printing services, it's fleet activities, and some technology activities. It's just internal business operations. We do charge each other. We charge federal grants, for example, for printing services.
So you make money off of other entities besides the university.
By the federal rules, we cannot make money on internal sales. We can only recover our costs. We can't make money. Can't make a profit.
So which department did you charge to print this outfit?
Mr. Chairman, members, this was paid for by me, not my office.
You charge yourself?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, back to the slide four. This just shows you the average annual growth in some of these major sources of revenue at the University of Minnesota. As you can see, state appropriations between 1994 and 2007 grew at an average, and this would be an average annual rate. It's fluctuated, as we know, over time, but at approximately 3%. Student tuition and fees, which, remember, reflects not only rate but enrollment, has grown at an average annual rate of just under 10%. And you can see the remaining items in the chart. It's just a little historical perspective. This chart, slide five, takes three of those, takes state tuition and then everything else, and puts it within a framework of constant dollars. So in other words, as you can see on the chart, that state appropriation in 2008, the far right yellow bar, is approximately equal to the level in 87. So adjusted for inflation, it's about equal with the level of 1987. Getting a little further into the weeds, I guess, of accounting and the budget at the University of Minnesota, I want to focus on slide six. As I mentioned, funds are categorized at the university as either sponsored or non-sponsored. But inside the non-sponsored area, which, as I said earlier, is primarily the day-to-day operations. Sponsored funds, while we expend them in a year, the sponsored grants and contracts are all often multi-year awards, and I'll talk about that some more shortly. But on the non-sponsored side, we categorize things as allocated and attributed, and that's about $1.4 billion of the budget, and I'll talk some more about this in a minute, but that represents the state O&M dollars, the state specials and tuitions and center reserves, and then there's about $1.1 billion of local unit-generated revenue. Now, bear in mind, the university is a very decentralized organization, and the activities at the local level, there's a lot of activity that raises money, and you can see here auxiliary operations. I mentioned it earlier, the housing, the parking, the intercollegiate athletics, the food service, about $285 million a year, and then another roughly $850 million of clinical income that's raised in the School of Dentistry. There's indirect costs, restricted income, grants and contracts, with business and industry, et cetera. Getting one step below that chart, the accounting system at the University of Minnesota. What we focus on at the institutional level is roughly 51 what we call primary organizational units. They're the academic and support units. Example would be CLA, or the president's office, or the Board of Regents, or IT, or the medical school. But underneath that level, there's the secondary level of accounting, is departments. There's roughly 419 departments. And underneath that in our accounting system are what we call depth IDs, or what you could refer to as activities. There's about 2,100 activities that people track their spending on. Inside any given primary organizational unit at the University of Minnesota, they could be funded by a variety of different funds. Some are more complex than the others. The medical school is extremely complex. The law school is a little less complex. But inside every one of those funds, and there's 82 different funds that we manage to, inside that are accounts where all the budgeting at the university takes place with respect to either functions, instruction, research, academic support, and object of expenditure, salaries, fringe, supplies, equipment, and are currently in the accounting system, and it grows every day, roughly 85,000 unique accounts where people track spending. Now, in your handout, there's a attachment 3 that gives you the definition by function so people can understand, because I'm going to show you a chart here on slide 8 as to where the money is spent both by object of expenditure, and you can tell on the left side of slide 8 that we're a people business, and roughly 62% of the expenditures in any given year relate to salary and fringe costs. And you can see the other parts of the pie. But as I said, we not only track expenditures by object, we track them by function. How much did we spend on instruction or research or public service, institutional support, auxiliary, academic support, and student services? So in all of these 85,000 accounts where spending is tracked, it's tracked both by function and by object of expenditure. And we can slice and dice and look at all this information within the university's accounting system.
Representative Haas, would you like to see all 85,000 accounts?
Yeah, sure.
Send them to you on technology?
Yeah, put it up in the story.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, just back quickly to sponsored funding. In 2008, the university was awarded roughly $675 million in sponsored awards. You can see the academic units that are the primary beneficiaries, the medical school, and IT, Institute of Technology and Public Health are the big players in this sponsored award activity. This increase over was an 8.3% or roughly $56 million increase over 2007. The expenditure of these funds, where does that money come from? NIH is the major player. $258 million in expenditures was made in NIH. Now, just a quick comment here. Federal stimulus legislation has provided an enormous opportunity for the University of Minnesota and the state of Minnesota to help on this issue that I think we all know about, the balance of payments, where Minnesota is really a net exporter. And the federal stimulus has provided in significant increases in these agencies, and the university is actively mobilizing to take advantage of those new opportunities. There will be millions of dollars available to us to access, and our faculty and staff are quickly mobilizing to take advantage of those funds.
Representative Downey. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Say, back to slide 8, I was trying to keep pace with you here. The object of expenditure and functional pie charts. Do you have that data spread across, let's say, from that same range, 1987 to 2007, so that we could see the trends on where expenditures are tracking?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, I can provide you with an historical time series on both of those, yes.
Thank you. And
if we could...
Just anecdotally, as we look at maybe the by function or by object of expenditure, are there any major trends over the last 20 years that you could just describe briefly to us?
Mr. Chairman, to be perfectly honest, it doesn't change a whole lot. Doesn't move around very much. Some fluctuation, but not a great deal.
Representative
Clark. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question about the meaning of sponsored awards versus the meaning of sponsored expenditures. Maybe you already said that, but can you explain the difference between the sponsored expenditures by source and the sponsored awards? Are they both coming into the top?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the reason those numbers will not match is awards are often multi-year awards, So if we get an award from NIH and the medical school, it may be an award of $20 million, but it will be an award that will be spent over 3 years.
And for the expenditure, expenditures by source is then just for that 1 year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Fistenreiter, is there a fee that's charged for all of these different, the medical school or IT gets these sponsored awards, then does administration take a percentage of that for doing the paperwork, et cetera, like you charge on an external fee on the internal sales activities?
Mr. Chairman, members, the answer to that question is not directly on the grant itself, but when I come to later in the presentation about the discussion of our internal budget model of attributing costs, the cost of administering, preparing the grant, administering the grant is recovered through a budget attribution cost allocation that I'll come to later in the presentation.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Going back to the leaving sponsored funding and going to that part of the chart here that I mentioned earlier of the allocated and attributed, the one roughly $1.4 billion. Principal components of that are shown on this pie chart, and O&M and tuition and university and fees, tuition and fees, represents the lion's share of this pool of dollars. These dollars are the most flexible resources at the University of Minnesota. In many of the cases on the rest of that pie chart that I showed you earlier, many of those resources are restricted to a particular purpose. We don't take, for example, money from parking. It's a self-regulating, self-contained business. We don't take that money and pay faculty salaries. We can't take endowment income that's restricted to a particular activity by a donor and spend it on lowering the cost of housing for a student. The most flexible money, and it isn't that the other money isn't fungible to some degree, but the vast majority of our flexible money is in these areas. And this chart 12 gives you a sense of the trend, the changing mix of state appropriations of tuition. The pie chart on the left for 97, in the fiscal 97-98 period, state appropriation was 71% of the share of this number, tuition was 29, and today state appropriation is 56% and tuition is 44%. And I can tell you that based on the governor's recommendation, and probably more cuts to come after tomorrow's, we hope not, that I've been waiting for quite a few years watching this, and I think the line between the state appropriation and tuition revenue will cross next fiscal year. That the total tuition revenue, which today is about $625 million, will exceed the governor's recommendation and what ultimately comes out of the session. The governor's recommendation on our appropriation for next year is $627 million. So these lines are going to cross. The implications of that, we'll have to see how it plays out, but I believe that tuition revenue will be a larger share of the university's budget at the conclusion of this legislative session, and it will be a larger piece for the first time, really, I think, in the history of the University of Minnesota, or certainly going back a long way. Why are those two sources of revenue so important? State appropriation and tuition represents 93% of the budget of CLA. It's 78% of the budget at IT. It covers 70% of the spending that the university does on instruction. It's 72% of the money that we spend, all of the money we spend on faculty compensation. These two sources are critical to running the day-to-day activities of the university and are very critical to several of the large colleges at the university.
Representative Clark.
I was looking at that chart, and you have an asterisk after, for example, ITCLA that excludes the sponsored revenues?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes. Mr. Chairman, members, it's 93% of CLA's budget. Without counting, CLA doesn't have much sponsored income, so I just wanted to be clear that it was just of the non-sponsored money, the flexible day-to-day operating money, not the sponsored money, that these two sources are 92% of what CLA spends in a given year.
Mr. Chairman, and then the 78% of the total budget of IT, again, excludes sponsored revenues,
Mr. Chairman, members,
on the other page, I think you had...
IT must be
129 and 1, I don't remember what the other one was.
Mr. Chairman, members, in a short while, I'll show you a slide that kind of gives you the by college look at revenue sources and how each college has different dependencies on certain sources of revenue at the university. I want to just turn quickly here to the state budget again. What's on this chart is the governor's budget, $33.6 billion. As you can see on the highlighted slide, higher education, which includes Minsky, the university, and the state grant program, is roughly 8.5% of the state budget. This chart shows the percentage of the state budget that belongs or that the University of Minnesota received. And as you can see, back in 1971, the university alone was 8.3% of the total budget. And today, under the governor's recommendation, we're down to 3.6% of the state budget. Now, I sometimes get in trouble with this slide because you have increased the money to the University of Minnesota, and we're grateful for that. But are those increases, and sometimes when you cut us, they're larger than cutting other people, that other pieces of the state budget pie have grown faster than the appropriations to higher education. And this chart simply points out that you have enormous pressures on the rest of the state budget in areas, we all know K-12 and the issues there. Property tax relief, aids and credits, health and human services, those public safety, those parts of the budget have been crowding out, and today we're down to about 3.6% of the total state budget. So we're 3.6% of that 8.5%.
Representative Mahoney?
No, I'll pass on it.
Representative Gonser.
Thank you. Could you tell me how many dollars you received in 71 versus how many dollars that you received in 08?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that handy, but I can certainly...
I mean, the whole budget was $900,000.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, this is simply a chart that shows the shifting priorities within the state budget. And I said it earlier, I always kind of get in trouble with this one. We have received more money, but as a percent of the state budget, we are not as big a piece as we were even in the late 80s.
Representative Gunther, what was a half gallon of milk in 71 versus in 2000?
I'm sure it was probably 30%.
Representative Mahoney, did you have a question?
No,
okay, go ahead.
Excuse me. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if this is a fair question to ask you. I hope it is. But if we looked at slide 12 with the revenue trends, and slide 15 when we talk about the amount of the percent of the total spending of the state on higher ed, do you know what nationally is happening with other universities in other states? Is this a trend throughout the country, or is this unique to Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, members, actually the University of Minnesota has lagged the rest of the country. The state of Minnesota has been generous in its funding of the university. There's probably, I know that Illinois is fairly well funded, but I think most of the other Big Ten schools, maybe not all of them, have crossed this line, and a lot of universities in the country have crossed the line between state support and tuition, and crossed it several years ago.
Representative Hahn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the slide 15 probably does get you in a little trouble. I was just wondering if there was a relationship of the state funding to increasing in Minsky proportionately to the decreasing of it in the U of M.
Mr. Chairman, I never run that, but I bet their chart looks very similar to this.
Go ahead, Representative.
I
was just wondering if, rather than, could you actually calculate that for me and get it back to me?
Maybe Mr. Burke can probably do that for you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative
doesn't want to take care of Minsky.
Representative Haas, Minsky has actually presented similar data to us before, and I can get some of that for you. And Mr. Fistenreiter is right, the chart looks pretty about the same.
Mr. Chair, you think it's congruent then, do you?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, this slide just is here to highlight how we get our money from you through the higher education bill. We get a, as you can see, this is actually reproduced from the budget that was adopted, well, it would have been 2 years ago, been modified since then. But we get our subdivision 2 gave us this block grant. We also get money, a small $2.1 million from the Healthcare Access Fund. We get the state special, subdivision 4, and then the Academic Health Center also receives roughly $22 million a year related to the old tobacco endowment that was set up during the Ventura years and then subsequently doubled up to balance the state budget, and that $22 million replaced that funding that originally came from that endowment. The state special, just to highlight, roughly $90 million. The biggest special, of course, is the Ag special. There's a small system special, one for IT. You can see the cigarette tax that's related to that, the Healthcare Access Fund, and then a Health Sciences special. These are the programs underneath the special that are funded with those dollars. That's slide 18. This slide, attachment 1, which doesn't show well on the screen, but is in your packet. We were asked the question quite often, well, where does the state money go by those major primary organizational units? So on this slide, I've shown you in attachment 1 where those dollars are allocated. I'll talk more about how the decisions are made later in the presentation, but for the staff and members, if you're interested in seeing who gets what of the state appropriations, the state special, and the cigarette money, this slide gives you that information. The next slide, oh, we've got a question over here.
Could you just define again what you mean by state special? What does that actually encompass?
Those are, Mr. Chairman, members, in the higher education bill, they are restricted line items that are contained in the bill. You can see it on slide 16, but there's an ag and extension special, a health science special, an IT special, a system special, and the academic health center special. And then slide 18 gives you a further breakout of where those dollars go by program.
Mr. Chairman, those are special appropriations that were passed through the legislature, in other words, right?
Right. They were in our bills. There were some ag specials in our bill and a few others for transportation. And I can remember, Representative Slocum, did you have one? No, Representative Hartman then had one, I think. Representative Welty had a number of them. There may have been some for Representative Norton, Representative Bly.
And Mr. Chairman, members, over the years, state specials have fluctuated up and down in terms of their number. Probably in the last 10 years, they've really been consolidated into these major four ones, the Ag, Health Sciences, IT, and the System Special. It hasn't been the practice of the legislature to create a lot of new ones, but I thought it was important for you to see the programs that are funded underneath those. And they're longstanding programs that really were, many years ago, line itemed in the bill to some extent, and have now been consolidated into broader numbers, but the university continues to fund the sub-programs that many of which used to be line items.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Fritzenreiter. On page 16, subdivision 5 and 6, the Academic Health Center, is that $22 million that you're paying now, or is that the money that to cover the bonds for the biomedical building?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this $22 million is basically a block grant to the University of Minnesota, and it relates entirely to the $1 billion endowment that was created for the, I think it was a billion, back in the Ventura administration. It has nothing to do with the Biomedical Facilities Authority legislation.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Attachment 2, which is also in your document, but in greater detail, gives you, in a sense, what we call this at the university is the fund forecast document. And this is our version of a general fund balance document. And it shows you for O&M tuition, state specials, central reserve, and support units, the revenues and allocations that are made. It's our version of, I don't know how many of you have looked at the state general fund balance, but it's our version of that document. It is a rolled-up summary of the allocations made through the budget process and ultimately approved by the board. I'm not going to go line by line. It's an information item for those that are interested in seeing, well, what is the allocation for the Board of Regents or the General Counsel's Office, or what's the allocation for debt or human services or for Duluth by these funding sources. This slide gives you slide 21. I think I see a question.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I'm still back on attachment 1, and I'm looking under the provost section, and I'm just wondering if it's possible for us to get a breakdown of how much that is per student that are in those different areas, if we could get that at a later date.
Mr. Fitzgerald, can you get that information for us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, some of these, what would probably help is, take for example the senior vice president, provost line on slide 19, the $5.7 million. That doesn't, you want to know by student? Some of these are administrative units, some of them are academic units.
Well, that's why I'm looking at the Education and Human Development, Carlson School of Management, Humphrey Institute.
Sure, those that have better academic units, I can do that for you.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
This chart gives you a picture of, again, non-sponsored, not sponsored revenues, but non-sponsored major funding sources. So you can see, even though it's varied in attachments 1 and 2 about the dollar amounts, it gives you a picture of the revenue. So earlier when I said that liberal arts, College of Liberal Arts, second from the bottom, you can see it right here. The green bar represents state appropriation, and the yellow bar represents tuition revenue. So when I said earlier that 93% of CLA's budget is dependent upon those two sources of revenue, this gives you a sense of what the major revenue streams are. Remember that we have lots of revenue streams, but the major consolidated up revenues to support the academic units. So I'll pick on the law school. You can see that the law school, the law school has a very small, relatively small amount of state appropriation and is heavily for the law school. This represents all the revenues at the law school, is much more dependent upon tuition revenue. And you can see the major players in state appropriation. So the point I want to make is that when the university gets a budget cut in state appropriation, you really have to go to where the money is to cut budget. And you can see who's heavily dependent upon state money. Medical school, liberal arts, Duluth, IT, CFANS, and that's really, and the extension, having a lot to do with the ag special. So you can see how we have to approach cutting budgets. You could go, I have my vice president Solos here, used to be the dean of the law school. I don't want to pick on the law school, but we could pull the subsidy from the law school and save some money, but it isn't going to balance the budget because they're not that reliant on it. We have to go and look at where we have placed the state money. So I just want the committee to understand how challenging it is for us to cut the budget. And we can't avoid the medical school, we can't avoid CLA, we can't avoid IT in the process of cutting those budgets.
Representative Mahoney.
What does C stand?
College of Forestry. That's the old College of Agriculture.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know I haven't seen it yet, but is your intercollegiate athletic program, is that self-supporting? Does it support itself?
Mr. Chairman, members, no, it is not self-supporting. And on attachment 1, on line 18, you'll see the O&M support that goes to the Twin Cities Intercollegiate Athletics. $8.461 million in addition. Their annual budget is in the neighborhood, I think, of $70
million. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there, coordinate campuses, is there a relationship between the money we put in from the state and tuition? You know, I'm trying to eyeball the different bars for Rochester and Crookston and Morris and Duluth, but I'm not extrapolating that from the graph.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think when I get into discussing how we go about establishing these numbers and the decision process, I think hopefully it'll be a little clearer. The reason that Rochester on the just shows state appropriation at this point, there is a small sliver of tuition revenue in there, but it's simply too small to show up on the chart, on the scale of the chart. I want to move into the budget process at the university, how we go about making decisions. And obviously the...
Before we leave that, slide 21, I'm just curious as to what you said, you know, looking at the funding sources, and some of them are heavier dollar-wise, but not so much, as a percentage of their budget. So, like, let's say we end up with an 11% cut. So we'll just say 10 for making it easy. Would you cut the Humphrey Institute the same 10% in their state appropriation then as the Duluth campus?
Mr. Chairman, we avoid decision process, and I think that'll become clearer shortly. We avoid a decision process that does across the board. We have a process where right now, for example, all the academic and support units at the University of Minnesota are working on budget reductions that range. Everybody's working on a 5% cut and an 8% cut in their operating budget. But in the budget decision process, we make discrete decisions after extensive budget hearings. I was in two budget hearings today with the College of Veterinary Medicine and Dentistry, and ultimately we evaluate their proposals on what they're going to cut, and we make differential decisions. We make differential investment decisions, and we make differential budget reduction decisions based on the priorities of the president and the academic leaders at the institution. So it is not across the board.
Okay, go ahead. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I am looking at attachment 2 of the supplemental handout. I'm just wondering, it's that chief of staff / VP, and it has a total actual for fiscal year 2008 of $8.9 million. What does that all include?
Oh. Mr. Fitzman.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking back into the detail a little bit more to find that further breakdown. But if I'm not mistaken, it's Kathy Brown's office. Chief of Staff VP on the front page of, is that athletic period in there? Rolled up into there? Okay. We'll get you the answer. Yes.
Representative Anderson, they can get this to you either later or...
We can absolutely get to the detail behind that number.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, as I was saying, the biennial budget request really is a tool, an important tool we use to frame the annual budget process at the University of Minnesota. As you know, every other year, we embark on developing a biennial budget. Unfortunately, this year, that biennial budget won't probably be discussed much, but it does, in our budget process, lead to and frame the development of the annual budget at the University of Minnesota. When we went about preparing our biennial request, we focused on what we thought were three critical economic issues. We wanted to, in that proposal, have a compensation plan for university faculty and staff. We wanted, in that plan, to begin a new middle-income scholarship for Minnesota students and their families. And we wanted, one of our priorities was to provide additional funds to enhance our research efforts to meet the growing demand and statewide needs, really to, in my judgment, too, to foster economic development. Those three priorities were put together in a biennial budget framework in which we apportioned to the state responsibility for roughly 75% of our goal in compensation. We wanted to ask the state, and it's in our biennial budget document, for a new fund for a research program and money for a middle-income scholarship. On the university side of the equation, the university was taking responsibility for 25% of the cost of compensation, as well as all the other expenses that we have that we face each and every year, new building operations, utility debt, leases, financial obligations, our founders' scholarship program. That was the basic framework of our request. Now, we know that because of, on slide 25, because of the governor's budget recommendation, you can see that in the red bar. I think I presented this chart to this committee previously, but as a result of a governor's cut in that he gave to the university in his budget recommendation, the biennial $156 million cut, that our biennial request is really undoubtedly a moot issue, and frankly, after tomorrow, revenue forecast probably even further a moot issue. But what the university still faces, despite the $75.5 million cut that the governor did in our appropriation for the first year of the biennium, and remember, the legislature also passed a $2.5 million cut to our appropriation for 10 and 11, that in fiscal 10, the first year of the biennium, we states a $78 million decrease in our state appropriation. But in addition to that, we also have roughly $55 million worth of costs that we cannot avoid in the first year of the biennium. So our budget challenge is next year alone is $133 million, and we have a similar challenge in fiscal 11, although frankly slightly smaller than that, principally because the governor made his reduction in the first year of the biennium and did not reduce our appropriation in the second year of the biennium. I hope that's the case in his next round of recommendations, but I suspect it won't happen that way. So we're planning on, principally in the first year of the biennium, with a financial framework that, again, was based on the governor's January recommendation. And you can see for fiscal 10 that the first order of business is the $78 million challenge from the governor's cut and that lingering $2.5 million. The university faces costs and wants to make investments in this example, compensation, $20.8 million in cost next year. Now, that doesn't reflect any pay increase for our employees. In the first year of the biennium, we are planning in this framework for a salary freeze at the university. What that cost represents is an unavoidable increase in our fringe rate because the federal government establishes the rules for the road at the University of Minnesota for what our fringe recovery methodology is, because they pay fringes on salaries paid on state grant, on federal grants. So the Department of Health and Human Services actually decides the methodology, and we're stuck paying the bill. And a couple of years ago, the federal government changed that process, and as a result, whereas this used to be on a smoother trajectory, it now jerks up and down because they figured out a way that they could save themselves some one-time money by making this methodology change for everyone across the country. So in the first year of the biennium, we can't do anything about that $21 million cost. Despite the state budget cuts, the president wants to continue to advance what we had hoped we'd get out of our biennial request, an $8 million new middle-income scholarship program, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. As you know, or perhaps the committee is not aware, the university also has a founder's free tuition program where the university guarantees for all the Pell-eligible students free tuition. So we make up for all those students the additional cost that isn't made up through the state grant program or the federal Pell program. And that will increase our cost next year, $4.4 million, if we honor that commitment. We will face about $13.6 million of additional costs, unavoidable, new building operations, debt, utility bills, and leases. We also face contractual and safety and financial obligations. We have an increase in software licensing fees to PeopleSoft and Oracle next year. We need and will be adding additional police officers on the Twin Cities campus because of a rapid increase in crime around the campus of the university, and it needs to be addressed with additional police. So we face those costs that are unavoidable. That $134 million
challenge. Do you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry. To come back just for a moment to the Founders Scholarship, when did the university put that into place? I know I was a Pell eligible undergrad, and I don't recall.
It's been in place 5 years, Mike.
All right.
We're in the fourth year.
All right. I was there a little more than 4 years ago, so thank you.
So in fiscal 10, and I think I'm not going to spend as much time on fiscal 11 because I'm very convinced that fiscal 11 is probably going to change here some more, but to illustrate our planning process, the assumption here, again, on the for compensation is a wage freeze. The tuition assumption in this model in fiscal 10 is a 7.5% tuition increase, which will yield $44.5 million. The assumption on the reallocation in this model is a 5.2% budget reduction, and that's what units are working on right now. They're working on a 5.2% and an 8% cut. And that's $86.2 million that will have to be cut from the budget and to meet the state cut and to pay for the financial obligations and costs that we face in the first year of the biennium. That's the strategy to balance the budget. Now, two-thirds of this problem is being solved with budget cuts, and one-third is being solved with tuition revenue. I know the committee's concerned about a 7.5% tuition increase, and it's why, frankly, the Founders Program, which will protect I think I have a slide in a minute on that. The lowest income students, and then the new $8 million program for middle income, and that's a program for Minnesota resident students, a new middle income program that the university would finance in this model. And I'll show you the impact of that shortly. There are just under 41,000 undergraduates enrolled on all four campuses to the university, and people often ask, well, how do students pay for their college education? And I think it's fair to say there's just under 41,000 ways that students pay for their education. But when you take a look, and the university has been vitally concerned about the cost of education, and this chart just gives you some detail on what the university has been investing in scholarships. You can see, for example, under, I'll just run to the, down at the lower right-hand column, the Founders Funding. There's roughly 4,700 students that benefit from the Founders Program who, because of the money that's put in, not only by the federal government state grants, but the university scholarship, you see there are $20.3 million, that those students attend the university tuition free. We have put money into, if you look up, for example, under all degree-seeking students, the number with a university scholarship or waiver, almost 50% of the students get some kind of scholarship or waiver. We spend $114 million on that. This just gives you a sense of what we do to help students with the cost of their education. We also do...
Representative Detmer and then
Potts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and testifier. You said residents in Minnesota tuition-free. There's 44,000, you said?
Mr. Chairman, members, the Founders Program, which goes to more, I'll phone a friend,
okay.
Peter Zetterberg, just to give you the specific numbers.
Mr. Zetterberg, welcome to the committee.
4,700, I'm sorry, 4,700.
Oh, pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The number of undergraduate students shown here includes not only Minnesota residents, but also reciprocity students and non-residents. We have about 32,000 undergraduate students who are Minnesota residents.
Okay.
The Founders Program is available only to Minnesota residents who are Pell eligible.
Okay. And are they U.S. citizens?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the Founders Scholarship, is that a last-in kind of scholarship, that, meaning do they get Pell and then any other scholarships from whatever resources, so it's kind of
better.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. We package all students pretty much the same way. Pell is usually the first thing that we package. Then if they're eligible for a state grant, that gets packaged. And for students who are Minnesota residents who are Pell eligible, we then put in a university scholarship, the amount that's necessary to bring them to a level that covers tuition and required fees.
Representative Posse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have an idea how many students of those 4,752 receive other scholarships other than the state grant or Pell grant?
Mr. Chair, probably about 20%. Some do, but for the great majority of them, most of the money is just the Pell grant, the state grant, and their founder scholarship.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the founder scholarship take in to consideration cost, you know, living costs or anything like that? Does that make up the difference for those things, or is it just strictly tuition?
It's tuition and required fees. The student service fee, technology fee, if they have a technology fee. We put in an allowance for course fees. Some courses that require materials, for example, have a small fee that goes along with it. It does not, however, include books. It does not include room and board or an allowance for transportation or anything like that.
Representative Ponte.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What kind of additional support services do those Founders students receive? And what, you're just in the fourth year, you maybe don't have graduation data on those students, but I'm just curious about what additional support and their graduation.
Mr. Zetterberg, an answer for that one?
Mr. Chair, it's actually a very excellent question, and one of the interesting things about the Founder students is how diverse a group they are, not just racially or ethnically, but also geographically. These students are on all of our campuses. Some of them come from small towns and happen to be Pell eligible. Some are from inner city schools and in the Twin Cities area. All of them receive the same kind of counseling and advising that's available to all of our students. Some of those who we feel maybe first-generation students coming from backgrounds that would require additional kinds of counseling or advising do have those resources available. But My main answer would be that there is no single program that could possibly serve all of these students in the same way, just because it is an incredibly diverse group.
And do you have, Mr. Zetterberg, you probably don't have it, but Fitz or somebody, the question, the answer to the, do you have any data on graduation? Is that what your second part was?
Mm-hmm. The initial founder students are seniors this year, so we will not really have meaningful graduation data until sometime next year.
That would be helpful, just to have, to know how many started and how many completed.
Mr. Chair.
Could
I ask a follow-up? What about just retention rates? I know most universities track retention rates from freshman to sophomore, sophomore to junior. Do you track these students, and what's retention?
We do indeed track them, and the retention rate of this particular cohort is less than it is for the undergraduate student body overall, in part because they're the various things that we would look at to predict retention and graduation, like ACT scores and high school rank, are slightly less for this group of students. That tends to be true of lower income students anywhere you would look.
So, just so I understand this cohort, Mr. Zetterberg, you started with 1,000-some the first year and then added 1,000-some the second. So this is the four-year cumulative total.
Right. This program was, Mr. Chair Rukavina, this program was phased in over 4 years, beginning with freshmen in the fall of 2005, sophomores and transfer students in 2006, juniors were added in the fall of 2007, and seniors were eligible this year, fall 2008.
All right. Keep going, and Mr.
Mr. Chairman, members, you might as well just stay a minute. In addition to the efforts we make in scholarships, we have an enormous student employment activity, over $260 million in student payroll in a given fiscal year. Probably as many as this chart shows, during the year, we probably have in the neighborhood of 15,000 student employees. Nearly 30,000 will be employed over some period of time during the fiscal year. So it's just, again, give you a sense of the magnitude of the effort that's made by the university, not only in the area of scholarships, but in employing students to help in their cost of attending the university.
Mr. ratio there of non-academic, the undergraduates to the teaching assistants and research assistants, is that typical of a Big Ten school, would you say?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, members, this shows a trend chart in comparing state and federal grants to university grants for undergraduates, and as you can see in 2008, the university's funding in this area exceeded the amount of combined state and federal grants in the area of scholarships. We're now nearly $70 million year in increases.
Mr. Chair?
Thank
you. Could you tell me, when we're talking about the university grants, are these funds just coming out of the block grant that the state gives you, or are these funds coming from some other source?
Mr. Chairman, members, from a variety of sources, whether they're O&M dollars or scholarships from endowments or annual giving, a variety of sources. Just a note again on the new program that we've included in our planning framework, and this is middle income scholarship program, and I think probably while
Representative Downey had a question before you move on, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, it was spurred by the previous slide, and actually all the way back to slide five as well. We're talking a lot about the dollars expended. I'm curious, could we get the student population, both grad and undergrad, across those same 20 years, and do you track degrees conferred in that same period? I'd like to just kind of see the output of the university across those same 20 years if we could.
Mr. Taylor, that'd be no problem.
Thank you.
Well, Peter's up here. I'll let him do a couple of slides here so that he's here and he does a better job explaining this than me anyway.
It's better, but you get handoff.
I get a handoff.
Chair Rucavina, you'll recall, of course, that the last appropriations bill in the 2007 session, if I can take you back to the, slide 29, the bottom of the left-hand column, contained some funding for a Minnesota resident scholarship. This was a relatively small amount of scholarship dollars per student that was to go to students from families with an income of $150K or less. Forward now to slide 32, and this middle-income scholarship proposal is similar. What we would like to do is target a slightly different group and provide scholarship support based on need in a significantly greater amount. This year, we're giving about $220 each to about 18,000 students. We would rather target about 10,000 students and give the lower-income students in that cohort, which would be just above the founder's line, a $1,500 scholarship that would then go to $1,000 for students from a slightly higher income and up to a minimum of $500. The basic idea, again, is to provide the greatest assistance to students from Minnesota who are in this particular target group from families just above the median income level. The target group would actually be an income of $100,000. But it's very comparable to what was done back in the 2007 session.
For the members that were on here on the committee then, and you all remember that we had this in the bill at 150, if I'm not mistaken, and it required a $1 or $1.5 match. So was that just a 2-year appropriation with the match requirement? It wasn't built into your base. It was for the 08 and 09.
Mr. Chairman, it was a recurring appropriation of, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Berger, I think it was a recurring. Now, I'd like to point out we were just cut $75 million. We were cut $2.5 million last time. So I don't know how many things you can put in the base and then cut to, if you get my sense.
But you got our intent. We can do whatever we want. We write laws that fit the matter. You guys obey them.
I was hoping, Mr. Chairman, you wouldn't remember.
Well, but I can't, and I couldn't remember. It was if the $7 million was built into the base for, in perpetuity or just for that 2-year budget cycle. Forever. And so, Mr. Berg, would you interpret the language then to say that the $7 million stays in that middle-income scholarship and then the match was required in order to get it or not? Or do I get it? Need a legal opinion from an attorney.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to look at the language and
think
about
we got it right here.
The money is certainly in the base. Whether the matching money is permanently there or not, I would question.
I remember the conversation, Mr. Chairman.
I remember it was 2-1, and you got me down to 1.5-1. I remember that. But beyond that, maybe Ms. Peterson remembers, too. So your request then in the budget request for the $8 million, was that for...
Mr. Chairman, it is a new program, but similar to what was last time. Because the state now, our binding request is really a moot issue. The state cut us $78 million in the first year of the biennium. It's still important for the President of the Board of Regents to fund this program, and we're funding it in our financial framework despite cuts from... despite the fact that we're going down $78 million in...
And many of us on this committee are sympathetic to your cuts. We understand that. We understand where most of your money goes and everything else. But I guess my question is because, of the governor's proposed at this point about 11% cut to you, you don't then determine that, we got cut, so this $7 million that we got, which required a 1.5 times match, disappeared, right? That program, you still believe, is in effect.
Mr. Chairman, it's in effect for the current fiscal year.
Well, I wouldn't interpret it that way myself. But maybe you're right. Maybe it's just was for the biennium. Because some of those things, if they're not written that way, that's the way they're interpreted. So you want to continue the program and lower it. And, I mean, lower the income requirements. And then would you still have that promise to raise, again, as much money, or was that part of your proposals for this coming biennium?
Mr. Chairman, this $8 million, which is recurring money, not one time, it would be recurring program at the University of Minnesota. We're coming up with this $8 million through budget cuts. We have $86 million in cuts out on the unit, as well as 7.5% tuition increase to balance the budget. This $8 million is in that framework.
Okay. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some of the same questions for the middle income as opposed to the founders. Just a little bit about retention, but before that, what's the student's responsibility for success? What's their requirement if they're either getting a founder's scholarship or a middle income scholarship?
Mr. Zetterberg or Mr. Fitzenritter or maybe one of the regents or anybody want to answer that, or recent candidates or anybody?
Chair Rukavina.
Go ahead, Mr.
Zetterberg. The admissions requirements are no different. The preparation requirements are no different. The satisfactory progress requirement is no different. All undergraduates on the Twin Cities campus, for example, are required to register for a minimum of 13 credits. That's true whether you're getting a founder scholarship or not. So we hold these students to the same high expectations that we have for all of our undergraduate students.
Go ahead, Representative.
How quickly are students caught if they are slipping? To some degree, either they're not attending classes, they're not performing, their satisfactory progress, does that kick in after one semester, or is that a two semester?
Hold a friend.
Come on down. Introduce
you. Chair Rukavina, members of the committee, if a student, my name is Robert McMaster, I'm the Vice Provost and Dean of Undergraduate Education. If a student goes on academic suspension, that is, they go below a 2.0 GPA, then the next semester they will have their aid looked at. And if they stay on academic suspension, then they'll have the aid taken away. So they're given kind of a grace period if their GPA falls below 2.0, and if it stays below 2.0, then there are long-term consequences.
Mr. Chair, are there any thoughts of tightening that up, making it a one semester, and the second semester there's requirements that must be met?
Chair Rukavina and members of the committee, right now there are not any specific discussions on changing those rules, but that could be something we look at.
So, right now, the freshman year, first semester, they screw off for whatever reason, they drop below a 0.20 right away, they get another semester of the grace period, and by the third semester, if they haven't improved, they're off the program?
That is correct.
Okay, Representative Mahoney. And then Representative Anderson. I'm sorry, Representative Anderson, but I'll let Mahoney.
I'm going to be almost, I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this question, but you don't if that student goes on academic probation, gets through that first semester, then the second semester has their aid pulled, you don't follow up with whatever happens to that student, do you? Like, they transferred to another college, they went to work as a street sweeper or as a legislator or something lower than a graduate of college?
Yes. Chair Rukavina, members of the committee, we actually do. the advisors at the university try to follow up in terms of what happens to the student, whether they actually drop out, or when they drop out, what happens to them, whether they transferred. Often, if there are extenuating circumstances for their lack of performance, we'll try to intervene and get them the counseling that they need. We'll try to give them another dose of financial aid to keep them going. So it really depends on the particular circumstance of the student.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
We ask a lot of the agencies that come up here. We have a lot of information, and if you have it, it would be nice to know how many of those kids that fell off the table on this scholarship actually got back up on the horse, went back to school, whether it's at the Twin City campus or Lakewood Community College. I mean, I don't, I'm not trying to make you spend 8 hours tracking somebody down, but it'd be nice to know if we're making that investment that these kids are actually progressing. I mean, you know, 1 year of college is sometimes a real eye-opener.
There are some national level databases now that enable us to track that.
Thank you.
The IPEDS data.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, kind of along the lines of Representative Poppy, and just you mentioned that the standards are the same for all students, and I'm just curious, what are the academic standards to be admitted into the university at this point? And you don't have to do it right now in front of this committee, but if you can get that information to me, that would be really helpful to know what it is to get admitted, what it is to qualify for these scholarships and so forth.
That one for us right now, because I've had questions.
Sure.
My constituents who, you know,
sure.
I mean, their kids have fairly decent grades.
Sure.
I mean, and they're Minnesotans, and they still can't get in. So go ahead.
There are no absolute standards to get into the University of Minnesota. It's done by holistic review. Each student is reviewed by a number of reviewers. It depends on their ACT.
What kind of review was
that? A holistic review. That is, all aspects of the record are looked at. Their leadership characteristics, what they did in high school, whether they were in clubs, whether they're an athlete, whether they did extra kind of service work for the community, and their growth within their high school rank. It's all looked at together, and then a decision is made on admission.
Whew, it's a good thing I got into UMD when I did, remember. So, okay. President Dammer, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In terms of your veterans that are coming back, the Montgomery GI Bill and the Minnesota GI Bill, do you have any statistics on the amount of students that are coming in with the GI Bill? And the money coming in?
Yeah, Chair, you could be in a member of the committee. I don't have those data right now, but we could certainly get them.
Mr. Zetterberg, do you have any information on that?
No.
Okay. All righty. Sorry, go ahead.
Rukavina members, I appeared before you earlier in the session and talked specifically about this chart, and I've added two things to it. One is some detail from the stimulus bill that I'd just like to briefly review. This is a good picture of how Minnesota resident students pay for their education. The 100% on this chart is the cost of attendance. And what the bars show is the percentage of cost of attendance that is covered by either financial aid or a family contribution or a loan. On the far left are the low-income students, and on the far right are the higher-income students. The two far-right bars are about one-third of our resident undergraduate students, and the other two-thirds are spread rather equally across these other bars. The dark red bars are Pell Grants, which are obviously very much targeted to the lowest income students. The lighter red bars are the state grant dollars that you can see reach out to students from a slightly higher income level than do the Pell Grants. The dark blue bars are current University of Minnesota scholarships for resident undergraduate students. The light blue bar is the middle-income scholarship we've been talking about, and this shows you how it would be targeted by income level.
What, Mr. Zetterberg, would that reflect what we had last year?
No, this is This is what the new program would look like.
What would that blue bar look like if we used $7 million and the mini match.
It would be, it would hardly show. It would be very tiny, but it would go way out across all of the income levels.
Okay. Go ahead.
The dark green bar are student loans. The light green bar are parent loans. The gray bars are the student and the family contribution. Student employment is included here. Whatever the family contributes to a student's education. Student's employment outside the university would be included here. Whatever else the student and the family are doing, what they're bringing to the table to help pay for the student's education is included in the gray bars. And Mr. Chair, I wanted to call your attention specifically to the dark gray bars at the top. This is the impact of the new $2,500 tax credit, which is actually a much bigger deal for students and families than the increase in the Pell Grant of about $500. There currently are, in the stimulus bill, there currently are both tax credits and deductions that families have been able to make use of, but they're up for a lesser amount and they're quite complicated. You can get a HOPE tax credit for 2 years, and then you can get a lifelong learning credit, and then for your fourth year you might be able to take a tax deduction. But all of those are for much lesser amounts than $2,500. What the tax credit does in the stimulus bill, and it's an expansion of the HOPE credit, is that, first of all, it's for 4 years, $2,500 for 4 years. Secondly, it goes up to a much higher income level. Families with an adjusted gross income of up to $160,000 per year can get the full $2,500 credit. Third, it's refundable, and the other tax credits were not, so that even if you don't owe any taxes, you can still get 40% of the tax credit as a refund, or up to $1,000. All of our, virtually all of our undergraduate students will benefit from this. And for most, it means that the additional amount of tax credit they'll get is about $700. So it is a very significant feature of the stimulus bill. It's obviously not just for the university students who are Minnesota residents. It will benefit our reciprocity students, our non-resident students. It will benefit all Minsky students, and it will benefit all students in private colleges, which is why I say it's a very big deal. And again, it provides a full benefit up to an income level of about $160,000.
I guess I got a couple questions on that. Why does that level out at $30,000 and above income? See where everybody's getting basically the same.
Mr. Chair, it's $2,500 for everyone, until you reach a point where you no longer owe any taxes and can't actually claim the full $2,500, and then it gradually moves down to a minimum of $1,000.
And I see that, but it must be a pretty good formula for lower
income. No, I just made that up, Mr. Chairman, but this is approximately how it would look.
Okay. That's good. I'm glad you said that, then. I don't know. Okay, let's go ahead and go ahead first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the current university scholarship, can you tell me again how much of the scholarships that are provided by the university, what percentage goes to students based on attracting the best and brightest in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, that's a very difficult question to answer. About 80% of our scholarship dollars go to students who have some form of financial need. But most of that amount is not awarded because we know that a student has financial need. So probably 75% of our scholarship dollar is awarded on a merit basis, whether it's a Central University scholarship resource or whether it's a scholarship that's funded through an endowment. Merit in that sense could have something to do with geography as well as with academic ability. But probably 75% of our scholarship dollars are awarded on a merit basis.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, we've been talking a lot about, especially on these most recent charts, about
young students, traditional students. And I'm wondering what percentage of the University of Minnesota are non-traditional students or students not right out of high school?
Chair Rukavina, actually very few of our undergraduate students are non-traditional in that sense. The great majority of our undergraduate students are the prototypical freshmen right out of high school. The exception would be transfer students who come to the university from either a community college or a state university or a private college, just as we lose some students to those kinds of institutions. And the transfer students might be somewhat older, but we really do not have a large segment of our undergraduate student population that one would think of as being non-traditional.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Go ahead.
And I guess this probably isn't just completely directly to next year's budget, but in looking at demographics and what's happening in the future, we're going to have an aging baby boom population, we're going to have a decreasing K-12 population, and we also are facing an economy that's tough, and my guess is they're going to be students that need to go back for retraining or may have a partial education and want to go back and finish. And I'm wondering, have you given any thought to how you might address financial needs of that population as they come back that are going to be an increasing amount, I believe, of non-traditional?
Mr. Chair, not in the sense that we have thought about having any sort of special financial aid program for them, but they would certainly be eligible for all of our existing scholarship programs. Frankly, the one sector of higher education in Minnesota that is most likely to see the largest enrollment pressure from students who want retraining because of the economy are the Minsky two-year campuses.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will be having a bill that comes forward that is about LILAC counts for adult learners, and I do recognize that Minsky is probably the larger recipient of that student, but I think with the changing demographics and K-12 students decreasing over the future years, I think the university is going to have to step up and start maybe looking at non-traditional students if you're going to continue to have the size of the university you do.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, this slide 34 just shows you, and I'll pick up the pace here, where the tuition revenue by source, just under 50%, 46% of the tuition revenue comes from Twin Cities undergraduates. And then you see the relative share from graduate and professional in the 40 campuses. This shows you where Minnesota ranks in undergraduate resident tuition required fees. We're in the middle of the pack in the Big Ten. We're not the highest and we're not the lowest. We're right positioned in the middle.
Go ahead, Representative Mahoney.
Is that with decreased tuition or with that 7.5%
increase? Mr. Chairman, members, that's with tuition current this year.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. Is that what you expect to see next year, or if other states face the same issue, you would be better positioned to find out if there's a difference in the world.
Mr. Chairman, members, we tend to stay in the middle of the pack here fairly consistently. We go up, other folks go up. I want to talk just for a minute, leave tuition, and talk about what we're doing on our budget.
Just a minute. Looking at that slide, this is probably a question Representative Reiner should ask, not me, but seeing that. That's your slide on 34, and then going back to attachment 2. Does it seem like the loop tuition is a little out of whack with everybody else as far as what they raise in tuition versus what they probably get from the state and the O&M and state special column?
Mr. Chairman, Duluth is a large campus, lots of students.
Well, I'm not talking about the dollar amount. I'm looking at the percentage versus, you know, what they're getting. I'm assuming you said the O&M money, most of that was from state dollars, so Duluth gets $50 million there and raises $82 in tuition versus Morris with $20 and raising half in tuition and Crooks in $12 and raising two-thirds or three-quarters, I guess. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Mr. Chairman, it relates to the attribution of revenue and cost that's embedded in our budget model that in a few slides I'm going to get to how that's done.
Chris, I have no idea what the hell you just told me.
We, Mr. Chairman, we attribute revenue and attribute costs to academic units and the campuses, and the state appropriation is used to fill up the remaining needs of each of the academic units.
The next slide, Representative Poppy and then Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question about page 35. This is tuition and required fees. Do you have a sense of how it fits with all other costs that students would incur, housing, room and board, whatever else that they're spending, their, even books, all of those things, if you continue to see yourself kind of in the middle or if it's up or down?
Mr. Chairman, members, I do not have that figure at my disposal. My intuition says we'd still be about in the middle. That the balance of the cost here for all of these schools is for room and board probably isn't that different. Room and board books, living expenses, pretty standard.
Representative Mahoney.
Back to Chair Rubina's question. Just for somebody who doesn't follow accounting rules like you do, are you trying to tell us that it costs more to have a student that took students more in Rochester than you have to use other funds?
Mr. Chairman, no, I was not inferring that.
I think we're going to learn in the next few slides, but perhaps I can't understand. Representative Clark.
I have a question about, on page 33, it says the average cost of attendance for Minnesota dependent resident undergraduate was $19,000-something. But over on page 35, the undergraduate resident tuition required fees is $10,000. Is that because you're leaving out living costs, or?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members, that additional cost above that is the board and room, books, living and miscellaneous expenses, transportation.
Thank you.
Okay. On budget planning side, I mentioned earlier that the framework we're working on right now assumes at a minimum to balance the budget in fiscal 10 of an $86 million budget cut on the units of the academic and support units. They're also working on an 8% cut. And we, in that strategy, we are looking at administrative cost savings, academic strategies to reduce costs, human resource strategies. Just a little over a year ago, we began what we call the REO program, which was an early retirement incentive option for our employees, trying to get in front of the fact that we knew the state had a budget problem. We have a hiring pause in effect. We have we're going and now planning on a freeze in compensation in the first year of the biennium. We're continuing to look at reducing costs, and we're clearly deferring investments. We've already taken actions to reorganize the graduate school and the academic health center. I mentioned the early retirement option and the hiring pause. I can tell you that there are going to be significant budget reductions in the academic units and support units at the university. I've been in budget hearings over these cuts that are already on the table. There are over 35 faculty in the Institute of Technology where the positions will either are vacant or will become vacant, and in this budget cut will force those positions not to be filled. There's consideration of up to 45 faculty positions in CLA. People are trimming supplies, they're trimming the library budget, they're not filling positions, they're reducing printing, postponing costs wherever they can. $86 million of budget cuts at the university is not a small number. It's certainly almost four times what we've done in my career there in any given year, and I've been at the university since 1992. So the cuts on the table are large, and we're working aggressively on those reductions.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering about not filling vacancies. When you simply don't fill a position because it's vacant, do you look at the consequences to the program? Do you try to balance out, supposing a particular program has three people retiring, What happens to that program?
Mr. Chairman, some of the budget cuts are going to have to be at this level opportunistic, but certainly we look at, we would not, if all the vacancies occurred in one particular program, we're not going to eliminate that program unless it's a low priority program. But you have to look opportunistically at this late date. But yet, at the same time, we do set academic priorities. It is not just all a shotgun approach.
Mr. Fitzgerald, since you brought up the graduate school, you know, I've had a few complaints on that. And I guess, you know, it was stated to me that a decision of this magnitude, that the Board of Regents and faculty and other students were not consulted before the decision was made. Is that a fact, or is that a rumor, or is it not true? Or
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to use another lifeline.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Identify yourself.
I'm Tom Sullivan. I'm the Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost of the University. A recommendation was made to President Brunix 3 weeks ago to restructure, to reorganize the graduate school in order to improve academic excellence in our recruitment and education of graduate students and to find efficiencies and to reduce redundancies, overlap, and barriers to the progress of our students. And the President accepted that recommendation, which was endorsed by all of the academic deans. 16 of our academic deans unanimously endorsed that recommendation. There were a number of people in the discussion on the campus before the recommendation was made to the President, before the President accepted the recommendation, and before a public announcement was made. Now, it is the case that not all members of the university community were in those discussions, but there were a substantial number of people that were in the discussions before the President made his decision, before that decision was communicated to the Board of Regents.
So, basically, the statement I said was kind of true.
Mr. Chair,
layman's term.
Every one of the 16 academic deans were in those discussions and endorsed the plan, and their names were forwarded with their endorsement to the President.
What are the financial benefits to the university for disbanding the graduate school?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have established an implementation committee to take the President's recommendation through each of the detailed questions to answer your question. Where are the redundancies, the overlap, the barriers? Where are the efficiencies? What are the cost reductions that can be deduced from that? The implementation committee, which is now at work, is made up of students, of faculty, of deans, of what we call directors of graduate study at the university. I think there are 18 or 19 members of that committee. They are charged with the responsibility of coming back with recommendations on each of those questions. How can we promote excellence and at the same time reduce costs associated as part of our budget challenge that Mr. Fitzenreiter has been talking about? So we have an implementation committee that has broad discretion, flexible discretion, to come back and make specific recommendations on all of those details for us. And we hope to have those answers in late spring. And then we will forward those recommendations to the President and see how the decisions are made with regard to advancing graduate education as well as finding cost reductions to help meet our budget circumstances. This is not a case where we are closing or reducing graduate education at the university. The purpose is actually to promote the excellence of graduate education at the university and to be able to find the greatest efficient way to do it. It is merely an opportunity to restructure. It is not in any way an elimination, and in fact, our goal is where we find efficiencies and cost reductions, There are three...
That's a kind of a long answer to my question, but from what I heard of your answer to my question was you'll have to see if there are any financial benefits for doing this. In other words, this decision wasn't made because of financial benefits. It was made for other reasons, and then you're going to see if there's financial benefits.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's our experience over many years that both are true. We believe that by restructuring, we can actually increase the excellence of the educational program as well as find cost reductions. We're quite firm in that resolution. Now, how it gets restructured and how you can identify those costs, we have asked this implementation committee to help identify those for us. For example, this is a academic unit that has over 50 FTEs and a budget in that regard of over $4.5 million. Our deans on the university campus are telling us that there are substantial overlaps and duplication between what the colleges themselves do and what the graduate school does. For example, students who are applying at the graduate programs have to apply twice, once to the academic unit in the college and to the graduate school itself. That's a redundancy that has cost the students. There are staff that have to administer those. That's just one example of where we think there are redundancies that can actually be reduced to cost savings that can be then passed on to students, our first priority, to be able to increase financial aid for those students.
Any other questions on the graduate school? I guess my final question on it would be, is this good for the students? Are the students going to be protected? I mean, from what I understand, the graduate school, in a way, I guess for lack of a better word, it is an ombudsman kind of, sometimes against, department heads or actually professors that these people were getting their graduate degree from. Sometimes it can be tough and there's personalities involved and that, so it's also going to be better other than what you're saying for a reduction in costs, how is it going to be better for the graduate students themselves?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your question is directed right to the point. We hope to be able to reorganize and streamline the graduate education function so that it is easier for students to enroll, matriculate, and progress through their program with fewer duplications, fewer overlaps, and more direct contact in the department and colleges with their principal faculty advisors. So it's really designed to help the students both from an advising standpoint as well as a cost efficiency standpoint.
And if I got a boom crash with my advisor, who do I go to? Because I know some of my friends who have gone back to get their master's degree at the university, actually, in this case it was UMD, where there was just a clash. And they haven't, to this day, even though they've taken all the courses, finished their master's program because there was this, interaction between the professor and the student.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, having been in the academy for 30 years, my suggestion would be that the student should try to first work it out with his or her academic advisor. If there is this clash, as you suggest, I think it should be next taken to the department chair or head to see if there could be some kind of mediation and make sure that the conduct is not arbitrary or capricious. And of course, ultimately, the student can go up to the dean of the college. And in addition and beyond that, we have formal grievance procedures. So if the student believes that he or she has been wronged in some way and has not been able to get relief, they can file a formal grievance against, in this case, the faculty advisor. And then there would be university officials who would look into that and investigate.
This guy came to his legislator, and boy, did his legislator screw things up. Okay, we'll keep going, Mr. Spitzenberger.
Mr. Chairman, members, little time check. How late do you want to, how quickly?
We're planning on being here till midnight, 1 o'clock.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll
even go beyond bar closing.
All right.
So just keep going.
Oh, my God.
No.
10 o'clock. We got an hour and 10 minutes.
All right. We're a little more than halfway. Mr. Chairman,
the purpose of this chart is just to show you a progression on the development of the internal process by which we go about making budget allocation decisions. And my point of reference is 1992. Some of you were still legislators here then, and I was a fiscal staff director here in the House, and I left in 1992 and went to the University of Minnesota, and that's sort of my benchmark. But back then, the university had just cut over to a new financial system. And that financial system came out of the Blue Ribbon Commission that was part of something that occurred during the Purpich administration. I like to call that phase the Infante phase. Jim Infante was the senior vice president for academic affairs, and this new financial system came, and all of a sudden we had all this new data that didn't exist, financial data that didn't exist at the university. But Jim was a mathematician, and the budget process was, on the one hand, we had all this new information, but Jim liked to do a sort of give me a 2, give me a 4, give me a 6% budget cut process. And deans would come in to that budget process and say, well, I'd like to raise my enrollment another 100 students. Can I keep the money? Because back then, everything was really more centralized at the university. And Jim would say, well, I'll give you 50 cents on the dollar. Then the next dean would come in, or chancellor, and say, well, I'd like to increase my enrollment, you know, 800 students, can I keep the money? And Jim would say, well, I'll give you 30 cents on the dollar. And then the deans would go have lunch and find out that the decision process was a little arbitrary and capricious, and the rules weren't clear. So what we embarked on was our version of something that was going around the country in higher education, and it was called Responsibility Center Management. We changed the name to IMG, or Incentive for Managed Growth. And I'll talk about that sea change that occurred in 1998. But that led to other permutations of the budget model to the point today in our budget that we have what we call a earned income and full cost model. So with that as a backdrop, we moved to our version of responsibility center management because people wanted more transparency in the budget process. They wanted to clarify the maze of cross subsidies. We knew at the time back then that we had to grow our way out of our budget problems. We couldn't just cut our way out of our budget problems. And we wanted to link performance more with rewards. We came up with a system, and this was the major change in that system. In the old budget model, if you state appropriations, ICR revenue, tuition revenue, all came central and were allocated out by the senior vice president for academic affairs at the time, Jim Infante. And as I said, central controlled a large share of the dollars. What we changed in 2006 is we attributed the tuition revenue directly to the academic unit. And we shared 50-50 in the indirect cost recovery money. What that did is it opened up the eyes of the dean, particularly those schools that admitted, were freshman admitting, that if they added another section in Spanish, they got the tuition revenue. In the old model at the university, that didn't happen. They'd have to come and plead for it. So we had a big change in the way we attributed revenue. And that, I mean, I don't know when the last time you heard issues of course access at the University of Minnesota, but back in the early 90s, that was a big problem. Students couldn't get sections. Well, there wasn't an incentive. So we aligned revenue with an incentive to solve a budget problem, to grow revenues and align the incentive center. Now, that led to certain issues, but that was a big sea change. Where we are today, we put in this system, but people still wanted more transparency. They wanted more accountability. We were still too reliant on sort of this base plus or minus methodology. In fact, we even had an internal taxing system that people got upset with. We attributed revenues, but we also started to tax revenues. And this model survived until 2006. And in 2006, the question that people wanted to answer was, what does it really cost to operate an academic unit? We knew what the direct cost.
Before you move on, Representative Poppy, did you have a question for this part?
Okay, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about an individual college requiring specific courses that maybe previously they were able to get from another part of the college. If I use just an accounting class, for instance, if you took accounting as a general course and now you're in a different department, maybe you're in an ag business department So the ag business people are now saying you have to have the accounting class that we're offering. Is there is that happening? And then it's also the second part of that question probably is for transfer students. How seamless is the transferability if they're bringing in courses from, and I know these may not be questions you'll want to answer or be able to answer, but how easy is it for those students to be able to come in how likely is it that they would have to repeat or take a course in a college because they would not be able to actually transfer in something because of the encouragement to raise revenue with student tuition?
Mr. Chairman, members, let me answer your first question, and then I'll turn to my colleagues for the second one. When we implemented this system, the faculty are pretty creative, and you have to police these systems. And it is the case that when we started, and we still attribute tuition revenue, we attribute, by the way, 75% of that tuition revenue to the college that bears the cost of instruction. So if a CLA student is taking a course in the Carlson School, and the Carlson School is paying for that instructor's time, 75% of it goes to the college, to the Carlson School, and 25% goes to the college where the student's enrolled. That's our internal methodology for attributing revenue. Now, you have to police it. I've seen a couple instances where people have been creative and suddenly they want to offer it hasn't been that extreme. There's been some cases where people get creative and say, well, this system, I can get the revenue if I teach it, so let's open up an accounting course. When you catch them, you hit them with a hammer and they don't do it. But it can happen.
Yes, Chair Rucavina, members of the committee. In terms of the second
question, it'd be like piling on credits for an associate of science degree in a 2-year program.
An associate of applied science, and I still support that.
Mr. McMaster, go ahead.
Thank you. We have several answers to that. One is that we have the Minnesota Transfer Curriculum. Mm-hmm. And what that states is if you complete the liberal education requirements at any Minnesota school, that same set of requirements gets transferred over to the University of Minnesota, lock, stock, and barrel, no questions asked. And that works pretty well. In terms of individual courses, there are often specific transfer agreements that departments have and colleges have. So for instance, it might be a student takes Geography 101 at Normandale College, and that course will count based on the transfer agreement or articulation agreement with, let's say, Geography 1001 at the University of Minnesota. So no, students really wouldn't get caught in the trap of having to repeat courses because of the agreements that have been arranged ahead of time.
Mr. Chair, that works when you have an articulation agreement. But if you do not have an articulation agreement, you're left open to having that possibility? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so. I think what happens here is that the admissions department, the Office of Admissions, looks at each course, will do a comparison of the transcripts, the content of the course, and make a decision, was there an intellectual equivalence between the two? And the decision is made based on that, not so much on a student having to take a course to get new tuition dollars.
I hope so.
Mr. Chairman, members, back to the slide. As I said, we've long known, even before the current budget system that we put in place, what the direct costs of a college were, what they spent on instruction, research, public service, how much they spent on faculty salaries, how much they spent on their administrative staff. What we didn't know and didn't have a good handle on was the indirect costs of a college. And my indirect costs, I mean, what costs because they were previously paid centrally. But what was the cost of the medical school for both direct costs and indirect costs? What did the medical school consume in utilities in the buildings they occupied, or the debt for the new buildings they wanted either the state to pay for or the university to issue debt for? What were the leases? What were the custodial costs, the building operating costs, the libraries, the student services, the cost of classrooms, research support, and, of course, the administrative unit? And the budget model we put in place for the major, the primary organizational units at the university can answer that question. And the new budget model, or the one we've been operating in for a couple of years, is that we now attribute all earned revenues to the academic unit, so all of the tuition, ICR, the fees, the gifts, the sales activity are attributed directly to an academic unit. Think of the medical school being an academic unit. And we also allocate to the medical school through a formula, different formulas, these particular costs. So they're allocated directly to the medical school or CLA or IT, so that we know in the budget process, in our part of our deliberations, what are the direct costs and indirect costs, what is the medical school costing us. What we hold back in the budget process is the state appropriation. So every year in the budget process, we look at this framework for the medical school, and a decision is made based on priorities. Where are we going to invest? Where are we going to cut? Where are we going to reallocate? What new programs are we going to do? We allocate the state appropriation that, as I said earlier, really fills up the budget of these academic units. Our process for allocating those costs are on slide 44. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through them, but we've spent an enormous amount of time coming up with algorithms, and I'll give you a couple of examples. The costs we allocate in the end of the day are typically fall into three buckets. They're either based on consumption, and we did that because we wanted to create another incentive towards some desirable behavior. So, for example, we know where every faculty and staff sit in a building, and they're so for the medical school, we know what space they occupy, and every building on the Twin Cities campus, for example, is metered for their utility. So we know what the medical school, what space they're occupying, and we attribute the utility bill to them. Now, or the custodial cost. If they want to give up space to save money, they can give up the space. If they want to conserve energy in their building, it will lower their cost. And so we have certain costs that are based on consumption. Some are cost drivers. They act as a proxy, and some are just a common good. We could have made this system really complicated and had 40 or 50 strategies to allocate costs. We focused on 9. Facility operations, we charge, for example, building services, the custodial costs, the waste, the recycling, R&R costs, land care and maintenance, on assignable square foot. So we know what the academic unit's assignable square feet is, and they get the bill. We also charge on consumption for the chilled water, the electricity, the steam. And so it just gives you a sense of how we go about determining the cost of an academic unit and go about evaluating their budget and deciding. The question earlier from the chairman was, how do you decide that Duluth gets this much or the medical school gets that much? It's really a process of where we're going to invest and what the costs are. In fact, every year there's incremental increases or decreases in cost. That's the decision process that we go through, and we go through it for every one of those primary organizational units. Technology costs are done. We know what our annual costs will be to support the data network or our productivity applications or our business applications or the help desk, and that's attributed on a different methodology, a headcount methodology. At the end of the day, this gives you a flavor of how those costs are assigned to the academic unit. And it's interesting to see then who really bears these costs. And the example up here on the left top part of this chart is the medical school. You can see that the medical school is a large budget at the university. If you remember that bar chart earlier, there are over a $300 million annual budget in non-sponsored alums, but they have a lot of facilities, and they have a lot of expensive facilities. The utility and air handling requirements and buildings that are occupied by the medical school are expensive to operate. They have debt costs because they're picking up a portion of a one-third debt when the state authorizes a new building. That's attributed to the medical school. You contrast that with the Carlson School. They have more students than the medical school does, and the student bill is handed out based on the number of a complicated formula, but basically the number of students. So you can see how the budget model itself influences the cost structure of these schools and ultimately influences how the state appropriation is allocated. This shows you a picture in 07 of the direct costs and the indirect costs based on this entire budget model. I'll stop here and just see if there's questions about the budget model and how we go about assigning costs and making decisions. And after that, if there aren't too many, I'll go on to, I know the committee has questions about debt and capital management, capital financing at the university.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have that previous slide? Do you have that information for the coordinate campuses as well?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I can get that for you.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, does the administrative services, does that include the salaries of the administrators?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes.
Okay, what else does it include?
The administrative service cost pool includes the president's office, the budget office, the board of regents, the controller's office, the general counsel's office. I can get you a list of the organizational units that are part of the administrative cost pool that is assigned out to the academic unit. And that slice on this pie represents each school's share of that overall cost. And it is attributed based on the size of their overall budget.
So, for example, this.
So the larger the budget, the more that unit is assigned the cost. And it tends to be that the larger the budget, the more time-consuming the administrative activity is at the university.
President Clark, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I was just trying to understand, looking at the medical school, it looks like it's about a fourth of the budget cost, right, the medical school? Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, members, remember, this pie chart represents the cost attribution component that goes to each one of these schools. It does not represent the entire budget of the medical school. It's their share of those nine cost pools that are attributed out to each of the schools. And it simply shows you how the internal budget process at the university assigns costs to the academic units to reflect that component. It answers the question, what are the indirect costs of the medical school or the Carlson School or of Liberal Arts or CBS or any one of the other academic units?
Okay.
It's an integral part of understanding the cost of an academic unit at the University of Minnesota.
Okay. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned in the previous slide that you're trying to link performance to rewards, and I'm curious whether or not, or maybe you could describe how that works and whether or not you've seen positive trends in these cost elements through that reward system.
Mr. Chairman, I think if you had a dean up here, they have a different view of this, but because they're the recipients of the cost and they don't necessarily go down much every year because the utility bills go off or the debt goes up, or we have a financial aid program and that cost goes up. But I will tell you that what has improved at the university is the dialogue between, many people view these as as sort of a central overhead cost. But the transparency and the understanding on the part of the academic units, the deans and the faculty, as to what's driving costs. So, for example, when a dean wants a new building, they now understand more clearly that if they get a new building, they're going to face more costs. They're going to get the custodial attributed to them. They're going to get the debt attributed to them. And they have to pause and think about whether they can afford that expense.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when we talk about rewards, are there actual compensation incentives for better performance in these cost areas?
Mr. Chairman, the pressure really falls back. Another element of this is when we attribute those costs out to the colleges, their pressure back for Central to become more cost efficient, to save energy, for example. Don't just pass the cost on, but we purchase gas futures to try to keep the cost down. There's pushback and incentives back on Central to lower the cost, as well as for the academic units to control their end of the cost. But are there financial rewards back and forth? No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Christopher, based on what you just told Representative Downey about costs, you know, and encouragements, so let's take something like the Bell Museum. So how do they get, where would they be in a College of Liberal Arts, or where would they be, and how would they pay back those janitorial costs and debt service and that for a new, I can't remember, what is the total price tag of that?
The Bell, Mr. Chairman, members, I thought you discussed
right.
The Bell Museum.
Using that as an example, then, what you just said to Representative Downey. And how do they afford anything?
Mr. Chairman, members, that's where we hold back then is that state appropriation. And it may be necessary then because they either don't have the money. They're part of the CFANs. And CFANs will have to wrestle with that cost. But at the end of the day, it may be the case that an additional subsidy of the state money will have to come in to assist the unit. No unit in this model is on their own. It is a model built to make very transparent the costs, but we make decisions on funding them based on whether what their financial condition is at the time when that new building comes online, for example.
So, Mr. Chair, then, am I reading this wrong, that like the students at the School of Forestry and Agriculture and that will be the ones then that get assessed a little bit for the Bell Museum at a disproportionate amount than the rest of the students?
Because it's part of the
college.
No, I wouldn't do it that way. No.
Well, what if the state doesn't give you money for appropriation for that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we reallocate every year. Money. We move the state appropriation around every year, either because we're making new investments with new money, and even if we have new money, we're moving old money around. Moving on to and capital planning, the Board of Regents does require the university to prepare a six-year capital improvement plan. That comes in two parts. Part one is usually in May and June, and that's what we call the capital improvement budget. That's the projects that we actually have the money for. It's driven a lot by every other year by your actions. In addition to that, typically in the fall, we produce years 2 through 6 of that plan, which is the other leg of this, the other part of the six-year capital plan. What we do is we'll look at, it's an integrated approach. We're doing an assessment of our facilities. We're looking at where the new academic program needs and what's affordable. That's brought together and priorities are set on our capital request. The university does issue its own debt. And as of June 30th of 2008, the university's outstanding debt was $824 million, and this slide probably gives you more detail than you want, but shows you the various series of deaths that we have outstanding. This slide shows you the difference. On 6/30 of 2007, we had $796 million of debt outstanding, and on 6/30 of 2008, it was $824 million. Our average cost of capital on 6/30 08 was 4.26%, and the average life of our debt was 9.4 years. We, many years ago, had the state stop issuing the one-third debt, and the university and the capital budget now takes that responsibility itself. Our cost of capital has, in my judgment, always been lower. In fact, the legacy debt we have issued by the state, fixed rate, but the state's issued for previous one-thirds is at just 5.06%, and our weighted average cost is 4.2%. The reason we can do that is because we don't have to follow the state constitution that you have to follow, so our ability to issue debt is much more flexible. We don't have to issue fixed rate debt. We can issue variable rate debt. We can issue commercial paper. We can issue variable and swap to fixed. Our ability is much more flexible, and as a result, we can drive a lower cost of capital than the state does. Someday, someone should change the Constitution on that. This is the structure, our amortization schedule, Mr. on our structure.
I guess my question to you would be then, why did we have to back the state stadium bonds and the bonds for the bioscience buildings with the Fitzenritter accounting method.
Mr. Chairman, members, the state made a contribution to the stadium and the biomed. We are issuing that debt. The state is not issuing that debt. And we did, with the stadium bonds, for example, that appropriation was $10.3 million, I think, a year for 25 years. And because we were able to issue it for less interest than we assumed when that bill passed, we were able to cut 3 years for roughly $30 million off the overall cost. So that bond is 22 years instead of 25 years, saving the state about $30 million. That's why we issued the debt. We appreciate the appropriation to help pay for that. And we'll do a similar arrangement on the biomed.
Chair, to that point, where are we on the biomed?
Mr. Chairman, members, the board has authorized the $292 million that relates to the biomed facility. We'll be issuing what you would call the first tranche of that debt, roughly $16 million in the next, probably 30 to 60 days for the first project. The Center for Magnetic Resonance Research is an addition onto that building for the work that's being done over there. It's a huge magnet, so keep your pens in your pocket when you're over there. It's a massive, I think, 16 tesla magnet that's going in that building. We'll be issuing that shortly.
And Mr. Fitzenritter, I imagine it's not easy. You had some private sources that you had thought you would be raising money to help with all of the other three buildings or four buildings or whatever it is. Yeah. So given the economy and that, and given the fact that the governor, you know, and the legislature are arguing about how much debt we should issue, and a lot of us want to get the economy going, and that sitting there unused at this point is what would happen if the legislature decided to pull back on some of those dreams of yours there, because I don't know if you're going to be raising money or not for the rest of that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the university has committed to either debt finance or fundraise the 25% share, and we're actively fundraising, but if necessary, we will issue the debt and pay for that debt, as in our budget model will be signed to the medical school or any other occupant of those buildings, whoever it is.
Okay, go ahead.
This is the amortization schedule. What we do, and you saw the average life of our debt is relatively short. We follow a practice very similar to the state in that regard. And you can see on this chart the amortization schedule. We our goal is we issue the debt, we set up the amortization schedule to pay it off quickly, and in order to recycle that debt capacity. When we go to the rating agency for a bond rating, this is the general view that the rating agencies take, and they look at our financial statements, and they look at liquidity, debt burden, and operating performance, and I'll share some numbers of that in a minute, but they also look at the strength of management, our student demand, how are applications doing, how many students are applying to the university, but they also look at our state support. That's a critical piece of this evaluation, and again, if our budget's cut by the state, that definitely has an impact on, has the potential to have an impact on our credit rating. We are presently one notch below a, really one notch below a AAA. We're a AA2 with Moody's and Standard & Poor's. That is in the excellent category. This slide, there's a couple of key ratios that we monitor and the rating agencies monitor, and this particular one is a resource and leverage ratio, and what's depicted on this chart is this is the range that Moody's for a AA2 rating prefers the university to be in. This is the median of that, this dark line, and this is the university's line, and of course, given the recent, because this particular ratio has foundation assets and endowment assets included in it, with the declining value of the market, this particular ratio is has been going very well, but will now probably decline this year again. So we're monitoring this very closely, but we still remain above the median and within an acceptable range. This is akin to your debt policy, which is really debt service to operations, and we're not dissimilar than the state with respect to roughly 3%, we float around on this, but we're roughly 3%. Our actual annual debt service divided by our total operating expenses. This is another liquidity and operating cushion line, and again, it has foundation assets and endowment assets included in it. We do get credit for that in the financial ratios, but again, we're within the acceptable range, but trending down given the recent economic turmoil and a decline in the endowment. I've included in here some comparisons. Some people want to see how do we stack up with our some of the peer institutions, and this just gives you a flavor of 2007 and 8 data for the university compared to some of the other peer institutions. Just to quickly finish up here, the university has also manages roughly $2.7 billion in several areas. From, as you're aware, the Minnesota, there's the Minnesota Medical Foundation, the University of Minnesota Foundation. CEF on here is the Consolidated Endowment Fund that's managed on the university books. TIP is the temporary investment pool, the cash flow of the institution, which we invest. DIP is a group income pool. It's another small investment. So, for example, when parking, and I forced parking to raise parking rates to put money aside for depreciation on their buildings, so we don't always have to issue debt to do the next parking garage or to do repairs and maintenance on the garage or a parking ramp. Those dollars go in and are invested different for the long term until those resources are needed, and that's in the group income pool. We also have another amount of money under investment, and that's called Yaminko. That's our captive insurance company. The university self-insures for a variety of activities. We don't purchase that. We purchase property insurance on the open market, but we self-insure for nonprofit liability and items like that, and we have a captive insurance company to take care of that liability. This shows you...
Representative Green. Can you give me an example of a different funds in the consolidated endowment fund? I mean, the difference.
Well, that would be the permanent university fund and other endowments that...
So where were the founders is the...
The foundation is the University of Minnesota Foundation.
No, no, but I mean like the founders fund or the middle income, would that stuff be in here at all or no?
This is endowment. Basically endowment proceeds or investment of cash as income and expenses of the university vary month to month. This is money that's invested outside the university.
And did the, Mr. Chair, did the, were the, like the medical foundation or the consolidated endowment fund, were they invested differently in the market so they maybe lost or didn't lose as much or lost more or did they all basically lose the same?
Go ahead.
I can actually get to that in just a couple of slides here.
Okay.
This slide 56 shows you the value of the funds as of June of 07, June of 08, and December of 2008. And you can see on our side, on the university managed side, the consolidated endowment fund, the long-term reserves, short-term reserves, and an assets related to debt that's been invested. You can see Romeco on the other category. You see Minnesota Medical Foundation and the University of Minnesota Foundation. Each of these endowments are invested slightly differently. And this slide 67 shows you an example of how the consolidated endowment fund is invested. And the Board of Regents has a policy on how much of our endowment would go to public equity, private capital, real assets, or fixed income. And that policy is what drives what's really called our asset allocation strategy. And the University of Minnesota Foundation would have has a similar policy but may weight these asset classes slightly different than the university might weight them. MMF may do it slightly different as well. It depends on the nature of their investment policy. Their investment committees that helps guide that investment.
Okay. Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What actually is in the private capital 30.8%? Are you actually investing like in private equity and venture capital, or what's in that?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
What's in the university?
It's all of the foundation. It's hedge funds, distressed debt, private equity, venture capital. Yes.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And would those be just anonymous investments, or are those typically kind of tightly coupled to university research and other commercialized technologies that's coming out of the university?
Mr. Chairman, not out of the university. All this money on this chart is invested with external money managers. Now, I will say that open up that can of worms, but one of the issues that the university faces in that private capital area is with some of the large venture capital players in the world. We made an investment many years ago, $125,000 investment in Google, and that investment returned a little over $50 million for this consolidated endowment fund. Those players like Sequoia have told the university that we won't take you into our investment pool anymore because of the FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, that there's a possibility because we have a contract with that venture capital firm that someone may come and find out because of Minnesota's data practices laws that they could get access to the particular investment that firm is making. So we have legislation moving through the legislature. We have authors. We've discussed it with the chairman of the committee. We're more than happy, and we'll always make available how much we invested, who it's invested with. What we're trying to carve out in this, so we can get back in the game and see if we can get another Google or a Yahoo out of it, that we can protect that information right below that in terms of who they're, what startups they're investing in.
Point of clarification to the committee, I was the Pitts and a few others came to me to talk about this. I wasn't necessarily on board, you know, but I listened with an open mind. I don't think anybody's breaking the door down right now at Sequoia or wherever to invest their money in the stock market, so, you know.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rippavina accurately described his position.
Okay. I'm very members, when it's public, the public's money, I'm reluctant to let the public have as much information as they should. But I think Mr. Iverson's working with my data privacy experts here at the Capitol to alleviate some of my fears. But could you, Mr. Fitzer and Mr. Chair, just give me a little more information on the foundation funds, what they consist of? Maybe I missed that part.
All gifts to the university for more than 10 years now, maybe 15, have been receipted at the University of Minnesota Foundation or the Medical Foundation. So new gifts, that new donations to the university are received at one of those entities. And the money there, so if we get a donor contributes to diabetes research, that money is deposited at the University of Minnesota Foundation or the Medical Foundation, depending on the nature of the gift. And that money is then managed by that entity. And that entity has its own asset allocation strategy that isn't dissimilar from what's on this chart, but may have just slightly different investments inside one of these asset classes, a different rate. They may be less public equity stocks and more real assets than this trust. But they're separate legal entities that the gifts are deposited at, managed, and it's out of those gifts that money comes back to the university to be expended for programs in the financial system at the University of Minnesota.
So if I if I ever became rich, which is probably a real anomaly here on this, but And I can gave a $10 million gift to the university and said I wanted it for a scholarship foundation for folks going into political science. So then would that division then would they actually manage that gift to the College of Liberal Arts or wherever it would be, along with any other gifts to that similar gift?
That's correct.
And so whatever they decided how to invest it would be listened to by whomever runs the foundation investments, and then their whatever they make off of it would go back to that picture.
Right.
Okay.
And we'd be happy to work with you on your will.
Representative Clark.
Would you assume my debt?
Representative Clark.
I'm just trying to listen tonight to figure out where the dollars that research dollars figure into this, the research dollars that research at the university get to do certain kinds of research. And I didn't really hear it, and maybe I just wasn't paying attention and carefully enough. I still don't see that on the budget here. I know that a lot of professors and so on really need to go after and seek those research dollars to get their, do their work and to keep their department going. Where is that show up on here?
Earlier in the slide, I showed you where the I have to back up.
We're going back to about.
Well, I saw sponsored awards and. Is that what we're talking about?
That's what we're talking about.
Okay, and so that's
slide nine shows sponsored awards by college, and this happens because the faculty puts in applications to places like the NIH. Or DOE or DOD, they put the grant application in, they're awarded funds to support their research.
I'm still interested in getting the information which I've requested a couple months ago, I think originally, about what the listing of the companies and others that have contributed to the research at the university. I haven't got that yet. I'd like it.
Mr. Chairman, I'll get to work on it.
Thank you.
That's really the end of my presentation. I would like to point out that Regents Frobenius, he's still here. Ramirez and Hunter are in the audience. I didn't introduce them at the start. They're still with us.
Did you have a question, Representative Poppy?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the capacity for student enrollment or the growth potential at the university, if you've reached it. If you have an idea how much further you can go to for student enrollment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we've had some long discussions lately about the capacity of the university, and we think basically we're right-sized at the moment in terms of the undergraduates that we have and the capacity for the curriculum to handle the students and give them a quality education. There are certain colleges where we think about nudging them up just a little bit because of workforce needs, and one of those would be IT, Institute of Technology, to see whether we could get some additional undergraduates in to fulfill the STEM needs in the state. But basically, overall, we think we're okay. There are certain nodes where we think we could add some additional undergraduates, maybe 50, 25, but I don't see we envision any kind of significant growth of the 29,500 undergraduates we have right now.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, I'm just wondering about the retention rate, and going back to that issue, I guess if you strengthened retention, how would then that impact your capacity?
This year our retention for the fall 08 class, or the fall 07 class, was 88.5%, and we're trying to get that up to 90%. Indeed, if we get it to 90, 92, that would result in a bit of a decrease, as well as improving our graduation rates. And once we reach those goals, our graduation goal, our four-year graduation goal is 60%, we'll see whether we have some extra capacity within the system to take some additional students. But I think we want to reach those goals first before we admit additional students.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to this point.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
Ms. Mass, is that retention rate an average at all your campuses, and do some campuses have a better than?
Yes, Chair, we could be in a member of the committee. The 88.5 first year retention rate was for the Twin Cities campus.
And what is it at the other campuses?
I don't have those numbers on the top of my head. Morris would be a bit above that or equivalent to that, and I think the other two campuses would be below that.
Representative Reiner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got two lines of questioning, if you'd indulge me. To come back, if we can, slide 21, I think it is. That was my original question earlier in the meeting, and Chair Rucavina asked along the same lines of questioning, and I know it's late and I'm a little bit tired, but I still am not following what relationship, if any, there is between state funding and tuition. Again, looking at UMB's numbers, where they're 2-to-1 tuition to state funding, I realize, you know, Rochester's new, where they're almost all state funding, but Morris is the inverse, 2-to-1 of state funding versus tuition, and Crookston's about 60-40. I know you said we were going to walk through it, and I'm sure we would, but I just don't grasp what that relationship is.
Mr. Chairman, members, because of the fact that we attribute tuition revenue directly to the academic unit, so in the case of CLA, the tuition revenue is attributed directly to them, 75-25, 75% to the student if they're, let's just say that CLA in this chart has 100% of the tuition if the student enrolled in CLA and took a course that was taught by a CLA faculty member. That's what's showing up in the yellow bar. Then there's the other revenue they earn.
Then we look at the indirect costs that they have, and we make a decision, a discrete decision, about what that green bar is, the state appropriation. So if you're a school that reliant has a lot of students, you're going to have, in our budget model, a lot of tuition revenue attributed to meet your expenses. So there isn't more of a relationship. There isn't a plan around that relationship. It's a function of how we attribute revenues and then what the remaining financial need is to meet the cost of that college. And that gets, lack of a better word, filled in with the state appropriation.
So, Mr. Chair, to sum up, you're saying Duluth has 2-to-1 tuition over revenue because it has 10,000 some students versus a Morris that has 2-to-1 state support over revenue because it
plays a role in the equation, yes.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make clear, in addition, when I say we fill that green bar up, we're also making new investments. We're moving that green money, that green bar around every year, either because in our biennial request we said we were going to invest in a new program in VetMed, and you gave us the money to do it, VetMed's green bar in here is going to go up. So new investments are also driving the magnitude of that green bar.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fitzgerald, I had a member of this committee ask me last week where students came from that went to UND, and I happened to be on campus on Friday, and they put together a couple really nice pieces of information for me, and committee members, you'll find them in your folder. I wasn't surprised to see that most students at UND come from the metropolitan area. I was surprised to see that there isn't a legislative district in the state that doesn't have a student that goes to UND. I'm curious, could your office or some office provide me similar information for Crookston and Morris? All right, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Pardon? Go ahead, Mr. Honey.
This is, you've got, some of you got my district is not having anyone going to the University of Duluth.
Mm-hmm. Just because yellow is that bill.
And I
just see colored ones.
Three of them
are
blue.
Watch
this in my closet.
Well,
I'll ask them to, Mr. Chair, I'll ask them to check their data.
Okay.
But I still want, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzgerald, I'm looking at the chart, at your chart number 21. Okay? And I'm looking at, you know, the state appropriation and tuition, and it looks to me, and again, you know, like the School of Liberal Arts is, the students are paying, you know, a huge chunk through their tuition, and then even at the Duluth campus, it's either tuition or, I don't know why that fee, it seems to be an anomaly in this whole list of different schools, and that the fees are a huge part of their income there, so, or part of their budget, I should say. So maybe you can explain it to me later, but it doesn't, it looks like the School of Liberal Arts and Duluth are a couple of where students are really taking a hammering, I guess, to put it any other way, would be.
Mr. Chairman, the tuition is actually less than the Twin Cities.
But why is the fee, Mr.
Chairman, I don't know if I want to take some time now, but the one thing that's a little distorting on this particular chart for the Duluth is that blue part you see here that you referenced, the fees and sales activity, that's the entire campus. If I did one just for the Twin Cities, you'd see that blue. Because what's in that blue on Duluth on this chart is housing and parking and athletics. But it's not in CLA or the medical school because that's not part of their Okay. Organizational.
And then it would make...
Okay, Reverend Mahoney.
And this is as much to Chair Rakovina as it is to Mr. Fletcher. Do you have this kind of a chart going back a number of years? Because my guess is that when we did a windmill up at Morris, the state paid for that, so that green bar went up a little bit, and the Carlson School of Business built their building, I can't remember how long ago, but there was a small amount. I think that was all paid for by corporate rather than state money, but so those numbers would change a lot. And Duluth, trying to think, did they just build up the engineering school? So I'm surprised if that's not a little bit bigger, but it might look different if we saw it this year versus last year or the year before.
Go ahead.
We've only had this in place really for a short while. And given the scale of this graph, you're not going to see big swings.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank Mr. Fistenritter for 3 hours of work, which he probably worked on all day, and I think it was very informative. And if any of the members have any further questions, I'm sure he's more than willing to help you.
Okay. Any other questions? No. Okay.
Any
sure. Yep. We're adjourned.